the Union in the autumn of 1941, but the notion of organizing the scientists in the Rad Lab did not die. A little more than a year later, in early 1943, Rossi Lomanitz, Irving David Fox, David Bohm, Bernard Peters, and Max Friedman, all Oppenheimer students, did join the Union, FAECT Local 25. The usual motivations for forming a union were conspicuously absent. Lomanitz, for one, was making $150 a month at the Rad Lab, more than double his previous salary. No one had complaints about the working conditions. Everyone in the lab was eager to put in as many hours as they could. "It seemed like a dramatic thing to do," recalled Lomanitz. "It was kind of a thing of youth. It was a ridiculous reason for forming a union." Friedman was persuaded by Lomanitz and Weinberg to be the organizer within the radiation laboratory. "It was a title. I never did anything," he recalled. But he thought in principle it was a fine idea to form a union. "Partly we were afraid of what the atom bomb might be used for. That was part of it. And part of it was that we thought the scientists shouldn't just be working on the bomb project without any voice in what happens to their effort." The union rapidly drew the attention of Army intelligence officers who had the radiation laboratory under surveillance, and in August 1943, the War Department was warned that several people inside the radiation laboratory were active communists. Joe Weinberg's name was mentioned. An attached intelligence report stated that Local 25 of FAECT was an organization known to be dominated and controlled by Communist Party members or Communist Party sympathizers. Secretary of War Henry L. Stimson weighed in with a note to the president. "Unless this can be at once stopped, I think the situation is very alarming." Soon afterwards, the CIO was formally asked by the Roosevelt administration to stop its organizing drive at the Berkeley Lab. By 1943, however, Oppenheimer had long since turned his back on union organizing. He did so not because he had changed his political views, but because he had come to realize that unless he followed Lawrence's advice, he would not be allowed to work on a project that he believed might be necessary to defeat Nazi Germany. During their arguments in the autumn of 1941 over his union organizing activities, Lawrence had told him that James B. Conant, the president of Harvard University, had rebuked him for having discussed fission calculations with Oppenheimer, who was not then officially in the bomb project. In point of fact, Oppenheimer had been collaborating with Lawrence since early 1941, when Lawrence began using his cyclotron to develop an electromagnetic process for separating uranium isotope 235, U-235, which might be necessary to create a nuclear explosion. Oppenheimer and many other scientists around the country were aware that a uranium committee had been authorized by President Roosevelt in October 1939 to coordinate research on fission. But by June 1941, many physicists began to fear that the German scientific community might easily be far more advanced in fission research. That autumn, Lawrence, worried by the lack of progress toward a practical bomb project, wrote to Compton and insisted that Oppenheimer be included in a secret meeting scheduled for October 21, 1941, at General Electric's laboratory in Schenectady, New York. "Oppenheimer has important new ideas," Lawrence wrote. Knowing that Oppenheimer's name was widely associated with radical politics, Lawrence wrote Compton an additional note, reassuring him, "I have a great deal of confidence in Oppenheimer." Oppie attended the meeting in Schenectady on October 21st, and his calculations on the amount of U-235 necessary for an effective weapon were an essential part of the meeting's final report to Washington. 100 kilograms, he calculated, would be sufficient to produce an explosive chain reaction. This meeting, attended by Conant, Compton, Lawrence, and a handful of others, had a profound effect on Oppenheimer. Disheartened by the war news, the Nazis were at that moment advancing on Moscow, Oppenheimer was anxious to help prepare America for the coming war. He envied those of his colleagues who had gone off to work on radar. "But it was not until my first connection with the rudimentary atomic energy enterprise," he later testified, "that I began to see any way in which I could be of direct use." A month later, Oppenheimer wrote a note to Lawrence assuring him that his union activities were over. "There will be no further difficulties at any time with the union. I have not spoken to everyone involved, but all of those to whom I have spoken agree with us, so you can forget it." But though Oppenheimer ceased his union activities, that same autumn he couldn't refrain from taking a strong public stand on a question of civil liberties. Across the continent, a New York politician, State Senator F.R. Cuder Jr., was using his position as co-chair of New York's Joint Legislative Committee to investigate the public educational system to orchestrate a highly publicized witch hunt against alleged subversives in New York City's public universities. By September 1941, City College alone had dismissed 28 staff members, some of whom were members of the New York branch of the Teachers Union, the same union to which Oppenheimer belonged in Berkeley. The American Committee for Democracy and Intellectual Freedom, ACDIF, to which Oppenheimer also belonged, published a statement condemning the dismissals. In response, Senator Cuder accused the ACDIF of having ties to communists, and a New York Times editorial lent support to Cuder's attack. Into this political thicket waded Oppenheimer with a strongly worded protest. His letter of October 13, 1941, was by stages polite in tone, witty, ironical, and then cuttingly sarcastic. Oppenheimer reminded the senator that the Bill of Rights guaranteed not merely the right to hold any belief, however radical, but the right to express that belief in speech or in writing with anonymity. The activities, he wrote, of teachers who were communists or communist sympathizers consisted precisely in meeting, speaking their views, and publishing them, often anonymously, in engaging, that is, in practices specifically protected by the Bill of Rights. Concluding on a note of defiance, he observed that, "It took your own statement, with its sanctimonious equivocations and its red-baiting, to get me to believe that the stories of mixed cajolery, intimidation, and arrogance on the part of the committee of which you are chairman are in fact true."